Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and I'm looking for a book about America. To help me are my friends Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
My name's Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, today I'm feeling particularly patriotic because last night I finished rereading the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and I think you should read it too.
Last night, down to the wire.
Down to the wire.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick.
Wait, hold on. Hold on, Ian. Hold on.
Hey.
Hold on. Hey. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Bum ba bum bum bum. Okay, you go. Bum ba bum.
Why are you singing the Marseillaise? That's French.
Isn't that an American song?
No.
Ah, shit.
It's got an American name, the Marseillaise.
Yeah, that's got an American name.
American.
The Marseillaise. You know what I feel like?
Okay, Ian, you go.
In this podcast, we kind of trash talk the French at various points. I was going back and listening to the episode about Alexandre Dumas. And I realized we're kind of mean to the French because we had a whole bit in that about how, well, you should go listen to it. But
that's
yeah, we
bad.
Do rip on the smelly French a lot. I guess you're right.
Joe, I hope
I feel
you're
like
nice
we're woke
to the French.
To so many other groups. I have nothing but complimentary things to say about the French today.
Okay. Just today. Though.
It is about the French in the 1700s, but
a certain brand of French. Okay. I'm going to introduce myself if that's okay.
That would be great.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book about America, I think you should read Beloved by Toni Morrison, a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Ooh.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Hey, Joe, I don't want to do this every week, but could you just run down the awards won, nominated for your...
Yeah, so any award that this book wins is going to be posthumously because it was published
Why?
After his death. It was published after his
oh,
death.
Oh, really? Wait.
That's just in.
Wait. Did he, like, write this? Is the last word of this book, like, and now I am dying?
Yes. So that's not exactly the last word of this book, but actually, much like J.R.R. Tolkien and Christopher Tolkien, a lot of this is assembled after his death from kind of various fits and starts that he had during his life.
Interesting. How can you call it an autobiography then? We're really getting into it already. Sorry.
Yeah.
Guys.
Good question. So am I starting? Is that what's happening here?
Fuck it.
All right.
I think that's maybe, I think that might be the most American thing we can do is just begin and don't apologize.
Yeah, just fuck it. Let's start.
To quote Lewis Carroll, begin at the beginning, go till you come to the end, then stop.
Brilliant. So offline, I asked you guys to bring two books about America because it's 4th of July weekend and or week or whenever people are listening to this.
It is at least a year before or after 4th of July.
I'd like to introduce a new format approach.
I'm excited. This episode's full of surprises, I think.
Much like America.
The great
outdoors.
The great melting pot.
The great outdoors. That's what they call America, the great outdoors. There's two parts of America. There's America, and then there's New York. And New York is called the Great Apple, and the rest of it is the great outdoors.
the famous Great Apple, the biggest city in the world.
So I think rather than you guys just stumbling over who gets to go first and strong-arming your way in, Arnold Schwarzeneggering yourself, I think you guys should both have to pitch your book in a minute. And then from that, we get to decide.
Well, it's really good that I prepared for this. I knew about this ahead of time when I was prepared for it.
Yep, it's a surprise segment.
Yeah, I'm willing to speak extemporaneously. Yeah.
Can you just, in the edit, can you just throw in like a ticking clock noise in the background?
I'll think about it. Is a minute too long?
Yes.
It's just a weird amount of time because like a minute is enough that I'm going to start getting into details. 30 seconds is like an elevator speech is 30 seconds.
All right, Joe, you got 30 seconds. What is your book about?
My book is the autobiography of, I think, one of the most influential Americans. It starts
15 seconds.
Oh, no. It details how Ben Franklin purposely structures his life and by doing so creates a blueprint for Americans to follow to this day.
Good work.
Thank you.
Was he always an American? Was there a point in time when he was not an American?
He was born in Boston.
Yeah,
I can see that your interest is piqued.
But was he American at that point when the America didn't exist?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think was a colonist. Yeah, he was he was born in the Massachusetts colony. He would later go on to I mean, I don't want to get into it too much here.
Yeah, your time is over. hey, Ian, I would worry about your 30 seconds, not about Joe's 30.
Okay.
So, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm so ready.
All right, go.
My book is a ghost story interested in memory and childhood and family bonds. It's about a enslaved woman who escapes from slavery near the end of the Civil War, and then she kills her child, and the child comes back to haunt her.
Jesus.
Yep.
You have 10 seconds, but should we take a moment of silence?
Can you give me a second to uncouple my mic from my stand so I can drop it loudly?
No,
the most American
that.
Of all genres, the ghost story.
Hey, wow. Man. Some would say we're haunted. Some would say America is haunted by ghosts of its own past. So,
wow.
Now Ian has to go second because he just used his last line, the line that he was planning on.
Dang. Yeah, can you splice that in?
I don't think I'm intellectually prepared to discuss these topics. Is that fair? Do you think any of us are?
Nick, you were the one who said, and I quote, "I want to do an episode about America."
So. Yeah, well, I thought it would be like a fun 4th of July theme.
And oh, I think Joe's is going to be very fun 4th of July theme.
Okay. Yeah, I would actually posit that I think maybe I should start because I think my book will lay the background for I don't want to say the myth of America, but I think my book lays the background for how we think of America, and I think Ian's book probably challenges that.
I think so. Let's do that. I love that a lot.
Wow, consensus.
Yeah.
Actually, I realized I hate it. Let's not do it. This is the worst idea I've ever heard. Cancel it. Cancel the podcast.
I have to figure out if there's a ghost in my book.
I mean,
that's where all the electricity is.
Ben Franklin was crazy enough. It probably counts.
It's Thor's ghost.
What?
All right.
What? What was that?
The electricity that Benjamin Franklin
Thor's
invented?
Ghost.
The ghost of Thor.
We do not have the rights to Thor. You're gonna have to cut that out.
As we know, all of our modern day electronics are powered by our dead ancestors, the spirits of our dead ancestors, captured and moving through our wires. And if we've learned one thing from the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, that is surely it.
This microphone I'm talking into is certainly being powered by Thor.
What does that say? What does that say about death by electric chair? That's pretty horrifying.
Yeah.
It's like a hug.
Yeah, you could say it's like a hug.
Like a hug, but not.
In a way, the death by drowning is like taking a sip of water.
Mm-hmm. Like a big old electric hug.
That right, actually Joe, sounds like a band, Electric Hug.
Joe, give us an electric hug with your book.
Yeah. So.
Hey, I got one more.
Oh. Yeah.
This podcast is like an electric hug for your ears.
Oh, that's nice.
That's nice. Maybe that's the promo right there. Maybe this podcast, welcome to You Don't Know Lit, the electric hug for your ears.
Yes.
My arms are open. I'm ready.
All right. So this week I reread the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. And this is a book that if I had to put it in one sentence, I would say it is Ben Franklin writing an instruction manual for how to live a worthwhile life. A few fun facts about this. He initially writes this book as a letter to his son. That's the conceit of it. As he's aging a little bit, he reaches a point in his life where he has achieved some level of success, and he tries to put that level of success down as informative for his son.
So how big is the book? How successful was he? How many pages of success was he?
Does he like laboriously chronicle every victory?
So, in fact, as he goes through writing this book, I think one of the charming things about it is this book is little. It's not a big book by any stretch of the imagination. But in this book, he details this life in which he is a successful public figure, and he's a philanthropist, he's a business owner, he's a scientist, he's a postmaster, he develops the militia, he does all of this stuff in this very little book. So the opposite of he details every minor accomplishment, he actually has this way of introducing these pretty monumental things that he does in a very offhanded way, right? Like in a very like, oh yeah, then I did this awesome thing. Let me devote 3 sentences to it and then let's move on.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
Was Benjamin Franklin a dick? Because I could see a world where he's just a total dickhead. Is he a total dickhead?
So maybe is what I'm going to say.
Is Ian's book going to prove that he's a total dickhead?
I'm worried that it might.
Okay. I should warn you, there's a whole section of this book about slavery. Just like it's out of place. It's devoted to just destroying the myth of Benjamin Franklin.
There's a chapter called Fuck Benjamin Franklin.
What were you talking about? We were listening intently.
So one of the challenges is if you ask me, does Benjamin Franklin come across as a jerk in this book? The answer is no, it's an autobiography. Yeah. Like he wrote it.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the challenges reading this, because this is the most definitive account of Ben Franklin's life. And he wrote it. I do think there's moments in this book where you read in between the lines a little bit. You know, you do wonder about the reliability of Ben Franklin as a narrator.
Yeah, well, I think that's safe to say in any autobiography.
Oh, I think it's part of the genre. Yeah, so this book starts with Ben Franklin leaving school at 10 years old. And he talks about his childhood. And he has some formal education. At 10 years old, he leaves. He starts working in a tallow shop. And this tallow shop A tallow shop is a place that makes candles. They make like oils for burning, but it's a dirty, filthy job. It's sooty. They do so by like melting down animal fats, right? Like it stinks. Like it is not a glamorous job by any means. He then goes on throughout the course of this short book to detail how after starting in this tallow shop, he slowly built up business, learned new things, gained new skills to become this American monument that we think of today. Monument's not the right word.
He became a statue. He became a statue,
and he is a statue.
Do you
today.
Think so? Like, there's statues going down all over the world, and mostly yes. over America. Do you feel like Ben Franklin statues are going to get pulled down?
Oh, yeah. Do I think Franklin's going to get canceled? Oh no, I don't think so. And I think one of the reasons is I think our recollection of Ben Franklin, I think our American idea of Ben Franklin has nothing but positive vibes in it. And I think part of that is like this mythos, this persona that he created himself in this book, in this autobiography.
Yeah, but all these people had a fucking incredible mythos. I mean, at some point.
He's good at self-mythologizing. Like, I think the Decemberists did a song called Benjamin Franklin. And I have heard the song, either it was for Hamilton or it was like in connection with it. But the song is all about, it's like Benjamin Franklin talking about himself, and it's all about like self-mythologizing. Like, I'm great, basically. Here's all the cool things I did.
There is absolutely a degree of self-mythologizing in this as well. I want to go over his accomplishments really quickly, but then I think we could talk more about that. Ben Franklin, he very much constructs this autobiography as I started from the bottom, now I'm here, right? Like he talks about like leaving school young. He talks about working in this tallow shop. And then he talks about like going and getting a better job, apprenticing for his brother, leaving his brother's printing shop. He travels to London where he gains new skills. He comes back, he starts investing, he buys his own printing shop. And he tells this story of Ben Franklin as a business owner who through industry, through dedication, through hard work, becomes a very successful business owner. And by all accounts, he was a very successful business owner. By the time he was 40 years old, he was more or less retired. He was more or less not involved in the day-to-day of his business.
What are like the, if you were to write his eulogy, what are like the top line marks? What are the greatest hits?
Yep.
Well, obviously he helped win the Civil War.
So Ben Franklin, we remember him most as a founding father, right? And I would argue that he's not just a founding father, he is the foundingest father. At the time,
that's a bold call there, bud.
The foundingest father.
At the time of the Declaration of Independence, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, at the time of the War for Independence, right? Franklin was kind of an old guy at that point, and he served as a mentor to a lot of the other names that we know today, the Hamiltons, the Jeffersons. If you knew one thing about Ben Franklin, it would be Ben Franklin, founding father.
Can I stop you? Because I don't know if you're going to get to this one, and we need to get to this.
Yes.
All right, so I just did a quick ancillary search.
Yep.
Hey, Nick, good use of the word ancillary. Can you give yourself a point? Can you? I know like we're not really keeping score for you, but that's a point in your favor. Well done.
I'm working on my vocabulary.
Okay, go ahead. I'm done with that now. Marking down that you got a point.
He's getting out the ledger.
All right. So all jokes right. aside, guys. The electricity thing?
Yeah.
Okay, so people speculate that because of Benjamin Franklin's connection with electricity and the kite and everything, that's like the reason that why it's called Frankenstein.
Oh, I would not have gotten to that. I've never heard this before.
I think it's BS.
What are you singing about over there?
I'm singing the song, the classic song, I Think That's Nonsense.
From Young Frankenstein.
Yep.
I don't know, man. It seems pretty coincidental.
But it's not called... Can I point out it's not called Frankenstein?
Oh, that's true. It's a really good point.
What a great anti-argument. Okay. Never mind. You're right.
I think if Mary Shelley had really wanted to make that reference, she would have called it Frankenstein.
When was Frankenstein written?
1819. Published in 1819. Hey, Joe, while we're listening, Ben's accomplishments... can I just ask you which bird he wanted to be the American national bird so I can laugh?
Yeah, so he...
I think this is a rare misstep on Ben's part.
Yeah, he might call this one of the errata in his life. He thought that the national bird should, of course, famously be the turkey because of its stupid representation of bountiful good health.
Why would that be stupid?
Turkeys are dumb looking. Turkeys are like... Turkeys look like someone made a bird from memory.
Are you saying turkeys, that we should...
Turkeys look like someone... Turkeys look like... If you've ever seen a wild turkey, it's like someone knew like they had to have various parts and just threw them together without any sense of proportion.
I disagree. I mean, if somebody was drawing a bird from memory and they forgot that it had feathers on its head, that would be... That person seems needs to go to see a doctor. Bird. I think we should start eating eagles on Thanksgiving.
Well, there's a, like, as I recall, and this is where my knowledge of Ben gets shady, iffy. But
this is where it starts.
This is where everything else has been rock solid, crystal clear. But didn't he say, like, he didn't want the eagle because it was, like, a cruel beast that fed on dead things?
So like, he does not say that in his autobiography, which is what we're talking about today.
In the section of his autobiography where he yells about birds for 200 pages. Listen, let me rank all the birds.
Let's reel this in. Joe, tell us about tell us why we should care about Benjamin Franklin, because this isn't just like a good book. This is the first autobiography that we've done on this show, meaning there's no like literary merit beyond this person's like worth, right? So like, why should anybody...
That. If the subject doesn't matter, the book doesn't matter.
Yep.
Sure. So...
Which I would actually argue with, but go ahead.
As he goes on in life, I think one of the things, because we're talking about why this is an American book today, and Ben Franklin really starts to lay the groundwork for how not only Americans think about themselves, but absolutely how the rest of the world perceives America. In fact, one of the fun facts, I think this is awesome about this book. This book initially was not published in English. The very first publication of this was done in France in French after his death, because Franklin was such a renowned, revered figure in the courts of France that like people just wanted more Franklin even after his death. So
give us
they
Franklin.
Franklin. And it's kind of crazy because like the second and third printings of this, when this became published in English, it was actually based on the French translation. So like when this was first published in England, they didn't go back to the source material. They took the French version of this and they translated it back into English. Later, in later years, that would be rectified.
Did he write it? So he wrote it in English. They translated it into French to publish it for the first time.
Yes, but he and never then they attempted the French, to publish this.
They translated the French version back to English.
Back to English.
Was there a sense that like it wasn't going to sell in English?
One of the things to understand about this book is this was written as an autobiography at a time when a common person, which is what Franklin would have maintained that he was, right? He would have said, I'm just a regular guy. For a common person to write a biography at this time, to write an autobiography at this time, was incredibly audacious, right? Like it's something that I think he has to frame it as a letter to his son. He has to frame it as this advice that he wants to pass on to his loved ones, because biographies, autobiographies are stuff that would be reserved for kings and emperors. Like why would we care about the life of this normal American
Rambo,
dude?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, and we look back and we say, well, of course, Franklin isn't a normal American dude, but that is absolutely how he presents himself throughout his biography, throughout his autobiography, and absolutely how he presents himself throughout his life.
Okay, so back to that self-awareness issue. I mean, there's no way he thought he was a normal guy. There's no fucking way. That makes no sense.
So my favorite part of this, I think the piece that made me really fall in love with this book is in the second section, he very famously goes through this exercise. And he clearly cared a lot about this exercise where he tries to attain moral perfection. Ian, are you familiar with this at all?
What?
It's ringing a bell vaguely. I think when I read it or when I read excerpts, I felt like it was pretentious nonsense.
That specific part? Yeah, and maybe it is pretentious nonsense because as a 20-year-old, this spoke to me. So in it, what he does is he sits down and he lists all of the virtues that he thinks somebody must have to live a perfect life, right? And if I start listing these, you'll recognize them, right? So he says temperance, like temperance is a virtue. Eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. Silence, order. Resolution, resolve to perform what you ought, perform what without fail what you resolve. Frugality, industry, sincerity, justice, moderation, cleanliness, tranquility, and chastity. And that's where he starts, right, with 12 of them. And then he realizes that what he's left off the list is actually the virtue that he struggles most with. So he adds a 13th virtue, which is humility. And under humility, he says,
be like Ben.
Yeah, actually, no. He says, imitate Jesus and Socrates is what he says under humility.
That's not a virtue.
Humble life. So he lists these 13 virtues, but just recognizing these 13 virtues isn't enough for him. Instead, he gives himself a notation system to basically say, did I achieve this today or not? Right? Like, so was I temperate today? Was I silent today? Did I achieve order today? And he essentially gives himself a scorecard. So one of the interesting things about this book is not only does it lay this blueprint for Americanness, but it's also in some ways the first self-help book, right? Like the most famous of American genres, right? The first self-improvement book.
So this sounds like really scientific, really kind of ordered and empirical. You know,
well, it's absolutely ordered. I'm not sure how empirical it is. I think you always have like this author's bias.
It's like a report card if you get to make up your own grades.
Oh, I mean, 100%. He talks at some length in the book about how he struggled by keeping track of all of them at once. So he would say, this week, so many high numbers here.
How do I keep track?
Says, this week, I'm just going to focus on order, right? And then he would go through and try to get order perfect. And once he was like really good at order, he would move on to the next virtue, resolution.
What's the culmination of this?
Ultimately, his culmination is he is trying to achieve moral perfection.
Does he?
Does he do it?
He says, what I found is that when I would attain one perfection and move on to the other one, like move on to the next one, the last one, like the last virtue, would start to slip. I'm paraphrasing here. It would start to slip. And he said, so eventually I found that moral perfection was unattainable, but I was better for trying it.
Hey, Joe. Maybe he's not humble. Or maybe he is.
It seems you like could just give not. That a zero.
Yep.
Would you say, like, based on your sense of him, is he honest? Like, yeah. is this one of the virtues? And is this, can we trust him? So like,
does he live up to the name Honest Ben?
Nick questioned whether, like, he would give himself good marks. Like, do we get the sense that he self-assesses honestly and maybe even like rigorously, or
I bet he does a lot of sevens.
Yeah, so it's so interesting that you bring up honesty, because as I look through the list, right, temperance, silence, order, resolution, honesty is not one of them.
Oh,
sincerity,
no.
Sincerity is, right? So like we get these words like in orbit of honesty. We get sincerity, use no hurtful deceit.
Seems like honesty should be on there.
I think the idea of honesty is really interesting, because it's very clear when reading this, especially through a little bit of a critical eye, right? Not taking Ben at face value, that he is very concerned with his image. And he talks about this openly at places in his book. So, for example, he makes his money from his printing business. One of the things that he does in his printing business, even after it is self-sustaining, he's like divorced from the business, he's separated from the business, or at least the day-to-day actions of the business, he makes a point to wake up at dawn every morning, go pick up all the materials that his various printing houses need for the day, and deliver them one by one to the printing houses by wheelbarrow through the streets of Philadelphia.
That doesn't seem particularly sustainable.
Yeah, so that when people wake up, like one of the first things that they see is Ben Franklin,
oh
right, local businessman, delivering these things to his businesses, right? And it is absolutely, he talks about how people love it. Like they love buying the newspaper from this guy that delivers, you know, that is still up at dawn delivering this stuff despite his wealth and status in society at that point.
Can I read an honest review for you guys? Oh, yeah.
Yes, please. Pause for an honest review.
All right, let's pause for an honest review.
How many stars?
This is, of course, a 1-star rating on okay. The autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, written by Abigail. You ready? 1-star review. It's a quick one, so pay attention.
I'm paying attention.
Who the heck want to read anymore if you have Kindle?
I don't know if that necessarily brings issues with the content of this.
Yeah. Hold on, Ian. Let's give Joe a chance to defend his book.
True. Joe, how do you respond to this trenchant critique?
It raises a lot of questions about what Abigail thinks a Kindle is for.
Mm-hmm. Why would you want to read this if you have Kindle?
Yeah. I have no response. I face you guys with shame because I have no response.
Abigail has conquered. He's probably smart, right? Like Ben Franklin probably realizes that there are more efficient ways to do like material delivery. But, you know, publicity is good. And this is like a campaign. This is a performative advertising campaign.
If I wanted to learn about Benjamin Franklin, is this the book to read, or are there better, more neutral books with more neutral sources? He seems incredibly self-aware.
So if I were going to recommend one book to learn about Benjamin Franklin, I would actually recommend the Walter Isaacson biography. It was very famous when it came out, but it's just like, I think it's called Benjamin Franklin by Walter Isaacson, famous biographer, has written the biographies for Steve Jobs, famously, Albert Einstein, really good, careful writer. And
why didn't you bring that book?
Because this is like the foundational text, right? This is like the foundational text where when Franklin writes his biography, writes his autobiography to his addressed to his son, one of the things he's doing is he is very much trying to make an outline of what a good American life looks like. Because, of course, when he's writing this, America as an idea does not exist. He is inventing America as he writes this, right?
That's pretty
so
cool.
One of the things he does very intentionally, I think, is he's trying to draw a picture, trying to paint a picture of the ideal American life, one in which a normal person, right? Just poor Ben Franklin, born on the mean streets of Boston, right? Like apprentice, leaves school at the age of 10, right?
Born on the 4th of July.
Do you think he had a Boston accent back then?
Ooh. I bet Ian
I don't think they
that.
Did. I bet you they wouldn't have.
When did the Boston accent start?
That's a really good question.
When did the Boston accent start? About 400 years ago.
I can't believe that.
About 400 years ago?
Apparently, it came from Europe.
Holy cow. Did you guys know that Boston people refer to water fountains as bubblers?
No.
Bablas.
So is Ben like doing this kind of both to make people better and to make the nation better? Is he just interested in making money or, you know, his legacy? Like, what's going on?
He did some, like, I guess vertical integration is what you called. So he did, wow, like, opened up stationery shops. He started a newspaper and increased the publication, which he had the rights to print. He actually started franchising his printing shops in other places, like in other cities.
He really started taking over the media. He owned all verticals of his
media. Would you say he was the Rupert Murdoch of his time?
Oh, yeah. you're going to love this.
And then he wrote his own autobiography. Really controlled the narrative.
He started writing letters in his newspaper, like op-eds under pseudonyms in his newspaper, that argued for a paper currency in the colonies, right? It got public support. It passed. So like, we got rid of our coinage. So people stopped carrying around sacks of silver and gold, and we went to a paper currency. Ben Franklin was the first printing shop with a contract to print that paper currency, right? So yeah, it's different.
Okay.
Yeah, difference, one word for it.
He draws this plan where he says, look, if you start from nothing, as long as you are temperate and silent and you resolve to do what you can and you are hardworking and sincere and you believe in justice, you too can be great. And great doesn't just mean wealthy, although that is absolutely part of it. But great means like we contribute to the public good. Franklin in his life would start the first public library. He would start the first volunteer fire department. He set up street cleaning, the post office. He was the first postmaster general. He started a militia, right? You can be inquisitive. His scientific endeavors are famous, right? Like you too can lead this life of worth and value, contributing to not only like yourself, not only your community, but really like the good of all mankind. And that is absolutely what we're supposed to get from this. Like we have this idea of the self-made man that comes from Ben Franklin. And at the time, we have to understand how radical this idea was. If you look at England, we're still working under somewhat of a feudal system in England. Like we still have King George in England at the time. And if you were born a peasant, you die a peasant in England. Maybe my favorite fact about Franklin, though, through all of this, is that when he died, after this totally exceptional life in which he was like a scientist, a businessman, an inventor, a politician, a philanthropist, a public servant, his gravestone has one word on it. And on his gravestone, it only says
honesty.
It says Ben Franklin, printer. Right. That's what he chose to have on his gravestone, because he said, even after like this whole life, I am still just a printer. I'm still just this humble, right? This humble
just a printer who
dude.
Owns a media empire and influenced public policy to get himself a lucrative government contract.
100%.
Where he can make his own currency that he invented, fulfill his own orders.
Every time I think of Ben Franklin printer, I get literal goosebumps on my skin. Like that is a mythos. Like it might be totally artifice, but it is a lie. It is like a mythos. It is a persona that totally inspires me. Like I totally buy into it.
Isn't there something like, I mean, like it's fine for us to sit sort of at a distance and judge this guy, but isn't there something kind
feels
of
pretty nice?
There is a respect. One respects someone who's so good at like a yarn, telling a yarn, a tall tale, and not making it clear what parts are very tall and what parts are normal, that like we sit back and we're like, you know what? I think a bunch of that is baloney, but I got to respect the effort.
But I don't care, right?
Right. It's like it's a good story. And whether or not like it's applicable to people, whether or not the idea that anyone can be a self-made man is or a person is in fact true, it's an entertaining myth. It's an entertaining narrative, and we still buy into it in ways that I think are structural.
You know, if you read biographies and autobiographies, I feel like you get these stories in all sorts of biographies, like these little anecdotes that people tell, and like the veracity of them, the truth of them is really debatable sometimes, but in a lot of ways it doesn't matter because it kind of builds that persona. It builds that mythos of these, you know, great people.
Ben Franklin believed that electricity was a fluid, an invisible fluid. Your thoughts?
I have no thoughts on that. I
just rejecting it. Okay.
Yeah, I have no thoughts on that. The cutting edge of science is all guesswork, right? And
true.
I have thoughts on it.
Yeah, Nick, your thoughts.
He was dead on. Pretty good.
Little did he know that electricity is actually the souls of our departed ones.
That's a callback.
God, you can't stop announcing callbacks.
It's like putting a multiplier on a
joke. Yeah.
Yep.
It makes it twice as funny.
Double fun.
So speaking of double fun, Ian, tell us about your really fun, lighthearted book.
Okay. Let me start with the story of Margaret Garner, which is a historical story. In 1856, Margaret Garner was a slave, an enslaved woman in Kentucky. She crossed the Ohio River and made it to Ohio, which is didn't have slavery. It was a free state. She was captured when she got to Ohio, and she had a child with her. And instead of letting the child be taken back to slavery, Margaret Garner killed her child. So death is better than slavery, being enslaved. So Toni Morrison, as she was an editor at Random House in the 1960s and 70s, knew this story, and she thought about it a lot. And she wanted to write a book about this story, but she didn't want to be kind of like shackled by sort of historical accuracy. And a lot of times when you're dealing with these kind of really grim historical moments, there is a desire to kind of get the history exactly right. And Morrison realized that good storytelling is extra historical. Good storytelling moves beyond, maybe starts with history, but it moves beyond that. And it's really interesting that you're talking about Ben Franklin, because I think Ben Franklin realizes this too. And his autobiography is based on his own history, but there's probably some embellishment. He makes himself, he downplays his flaws, he plays up his cool, how cool he is. So this text explicitly, the book I'm talking about, explicitly uses fiction to avoid any accusation of not being historically accurate. So kind of using fiction as a way to explore and amplify parts of this story that Morrison really wanted to emphasize. So the book is called Beloved. It was published in 1988 in the U.S., written by Toni Morrison. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for this book, and the success of Beloved, as well as her other successes, catapulted her to be the first Black woman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature in the 1990s.
She just passed.
Yeah, very, very recently. This year, I want to say.
2019.
So last year, she was one of these forces, kind of forces of nature in an era where there were a lot of really kind of successful Black women writers, and she's absolutely kind of one of these legends from this era.
Just to add on that sense, if you just when you type in somebody's name and then it finishes the sentence in Google. Yeah. Just to give a reference point, if you type in her name, one of the first questions is, how did Toni Morrison change the world?
Oh,
well, wow.
That's a pretty big, question.
I mean, that's great. And I love that that supports my claim. I'm not really going to use Google's autocorrect or auto predict as like a benchmark for my judgment of these things. But yes, that's like,
fine. Can I?
And Morrison's hot too. Morrison's like, especially now, today, as we're talking about slavery, as we're talking about sort of the role of storytelling to our national identity and the problems with our national identity here in America, Morrison's work, which is really invested in memory, is extremely relevant.
As a PhD whose professional life is based in research, you do or do not think that Google autocomplete is a valid source of information?
Let's square this one off first before I move on.
It's fun. I think it's fun, but I would not go there for my understanding of the world.
Yeah, specifically just makes my life as a fellow podcaster much easier.
Good. I'm glad.
So to be clear, for podcast fun, right? Like Google autocomplete is pretty good, but like if you are writing a dissertation or defending a thesis, right? At that point, no.
I might begin with Google's autocomplete, but I certainly wouldn't end with it. It's a good launch pad, perhaps. But all right. I would
thank you for the clarification.
If I was interested in like who is Shakespeare's son, I wouldn't maybe like just stick with what Google autocomplete.
Here's a segue. Ian, why don't you launch us into this book?
Okay. So can I tell you the story of it, please, briefly?
We would love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course.
All right. So hang with me here. It's just a tiny bit complicated. I read this out loud to myself, and it ended up being about half an hour. So
I'm sorry, what?
Just testing to see if you're paying attention. So the book isn't super long. It's a 12-hour audiobook, about 325 pages. The story is, she packs a lot of story into this, but I'll be able to summarize it fairly briefly. So our main character is a black woman named Setha, and Setha escapes from slavery near the end of the Civil War. She goes to Ohio, just over the border from Kentucky. Kentucky's a slave state. Ohio's a free state. But her owner, the person that she escaped from, comes hunting for her when she's living in Ohio. When she sees him, coming, she takes her four children, her oldest daughter, her two twin sons, and her youngest daughter, out to the barn, and she kills her oldest daughter, and she tries to kill her other kids. And she will kill them rather than let them go back to slavery. But even though she tries to kill all of them, only one child, the oldest one, dies. And Setha buries the baby. Yeah?
Yeah, just so many questions. Do we want to come back to this? We're
still getting to the ghost, okay? So Setha buries the baby, and all that's on the baby's gravestone is one word, beloved. So Setha goes to prison.
Before you go on, this is all based on a story. Can you start, delineating between, what... Is this all factual, or is this embellished, or...
So far, what we have is perhaps not, we don't know that, Margaret Garner crossed in the very same place that Setha crosses, but so far, to this point, the story of Setha lines up with the story of Margaret Garner.
Okay.
Including the one word, epitaph.
Well, no, I don't know about that.
Okay. Well, I just think that's such a nice connection between our books.
Yeah, you're right. Oh boy. Okay, so Setha has killed her oldest daughter and tried to kill her other three kids rather than let them go back to slavery. When her slave-owning former owner sees this, he gets disgusted. Setha goes to prison, but nobody gets re-enslaved. So you might say it worked.
Jesus.
Huge scare quotes around it worked, though. So this is where it starts getting ghosty. The baby's ghost ends up haunting Setha's house after Setha gets out of prison. Eventually, this is not quite clear how this happens, the baby gets re-enfleshed. It gains a body again.
Whoa.
And it comes to live with...
Like a reincarnate?
This sounds like a zombie story.
I wouldn't say that. It is. There is certainly a zombie vibe because the baby is not able to talk super well. And it interacts with the world in really weird ways, and we don't know immediately that it's the baby. That becomes pretty clear as the story goes on. And the baby's name is the person that comes to live with them calls herself Beloved. So the baby gets re-enfleshed and comes to live with Setha, and then the baby starts to feed on Setha's misery and guilt. And Setha's friends and family kind of gradually realize this is happening. The baby is getting physically larger, and Setha is getting physically smaller.
Wow. I have two follow-up questions.
What can I answer about that story? It's a bit, like I say, it's not a long book, but there's a lot of story in it.
Joe is chomping at the bit.
Joe, go.
So two follow-up questions. First of all, you say that Setha gets smaller and Beloved gets bigger. What do you mean?
Physically.
Physically bigger,
That's the first question you had?
Yeah.
The book describes the book describes Setha as shrinking, physically shrinking. And the book describes Beloved as becoming taller, and her skin, her flesh is filling out. And eventually, right before she kind of gets exercised by the community, she takes the form, she takes the shape of a pregnant woman. And part of this is the story kind of gives it this pseudo realistic explanation. Setha is guilty, and so she's feeding Beloved all of her food. Setha's not eating, but also there's very clearly an emotional thing where Setha is being vampirically fed upon emotionally.
This has a Dorian Gray vibe, right? She has this external representation of her guilt that is growing and changing as she feels worse and worse.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, although Dorian Gray never feels worse or whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah.
It's similar to Dorian Gray, but absolutely nothing like it.
It's got vibes.
It's magical realism, which is also Dorian Gray, but this, the character Beloved throughout, we get this sense like she's evil. And gradually we realize maybe she's acting in evil ways, but she's so sad and she's so like betrayed and angry. And there's finally one chapter, which is her point of view chapter. And it's just devastating. And
oh my God, it, but,
the slave owner that she escapes from is called School Teacher, and she sees his hat and she kind of just like, she makes this call and she kills her oldest, this daughter that she loves, this daughter that she dotes on, because she believes this is better than slavery. And like the phrase, a fate worse than death. And slavery is that fate worse than death. And so she kills her daughter, and then she is haunted literally by this.
Yeah. So
is this, I mean, this has got to be a book you read with just a knot in your stomach the entire time.
Like kind of feeling gross and miserable and horrified and stuff.
I mean, like 15 years later, yes. Right? After this happens, slavery is abolished, which obviously doesn't end all forms of slavery, but
right.
So she goes to prison as well?
Yeah, so the timeline goes like this.
Did Margaret actually go to prison?
Margaret was captured.
Oh, she was captured. So it's, yeah. It's okay.
Yeah, so like it kind of diverges. But yeah, so you say a knot in your stomach, and so much of this is just absolutely harrowing to read.
So I think this is like, it's implicit right now, but it might be worth explicitly saying. This week, we're bringing a book about America. Like we're bringing an American book.
Yeah.
I think we can start to see some of like the threads and the tendrils here, but can you tie those up? Like, can you tell us how, like, why is this the book that you think of when you think this book is about America?
Sure. Yeah. So, for one thing, it's really engaged sort of imaginatively with American history. For some reason, Americans really like to parse our own history. We tell it, we retell it, we re-retell it. This has to do with national identity. Maybe the fact that we're only 240 some years old, close to 250 years old, and yet like so much has happened. Maybe it's that our history has been told so poorly that we need to retell it properly. We hear about the Emancipation Proclamation, right? This is January 1st, 1863. And like there's this sense like this is a watershed moment in the lives of Black people in America, and especially enslaved Black people. But all of this story takes place, and the horrifying parts of it take place in the North after that proclamation. So it kind of, it's like these familiar stories, these myths, right? We talked about kind of like the mythologizing, self-mythologizing. You know, we tell ourselves stories about what America is and what America involves. This story kind of defamiliarizes that. The story of the classic narrative of like, you know, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves and then it was all okay. That's not how it worked. It's not as simple as like, oh, Emancipation Proclamation, we're all good. It's fine. Recently, so this is releasing on around July 4th. Are you folks familiar with Juneteenth? This has kind of been in the news a lot recently.
I'm more familiar with it this year than I ever have been before.
Right. So the idea is that this is the day in 1865, June 19, 1865, when the last enslaved people were told that in Texas, they were told that they had been set free, that they were no longer considered to be non-human property, which is kind of the baseline for humanity, right? So this is literally two and a half years after the Emancipation Proclamation. And the fact that it takes 2.5 years for this sort of this law to trickle all the way down to Texas. Like the stories we tell ourselves are too simple. The stories we tell ourselves are straightforward, and in being straightforward, they cover up a lot. So this book kind of gives us texture to history. And this book makes us realize sort of the nasty.
Certainly humanizes it.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is like, have either of you read?
Hold on, I'll stop you right there. No, I haven't read that, Joe.
Harriet Beecher Stowe's book, Uncle Tom's
Cabin. I also
Cabin.
Have not read it. I can stop you at Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Okay, Uncle Tom's Cabin was written in the 1850s, so 130 years before Morrison wrote Beloved. And Uncle Tom's Cabin is a story of, among other things, an enslaved person who escapes across the Ohio River to freedom. And this story kind of gives the idea that like all they've got to do is be free and black people will be fine. Right. And while the book was great for kind of introducing abolitionist sentiment to abolish slavery, there are a lot of problems with Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I think the image of Setha crossing the Ohio River, getting to Ohio, and then a month later, her school, the school teacher shows up to try and take her back. And then she is caught in this web of misery and guilt. Freedom is not as simple as crossing a river. Freedom is not as simple as a gesture, as a little symbolic act. Freedom, it goes so much farther than that. It's a process. And I think this is
it's such a relevant point, right? And we could think of this in a thousand different ways. And I think part of it is how we're taught these things when we're young, yeah. right? Like, so that your example of the Emancipation Proclamation is a great one, right? So we have the Emancipation Proclamation, and as a kid, you are kind of taught, and maybe this is never explicitly said, but the feeling that you get is there was slavery, that was bad, then Abraham Lincoln happened, and then it stopped, right? And we fought a war, by the way, right? We get the same narrative with Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Act, right?
Absolutely.
Like, it's like, and then after that, well, slavery was over, but black people really had kind of a bad time of things for 100 years, right? But then this other guy came along, and his name was Martin Luther King, and he gave this awesome speech, and then like black people got their rights, right? Like that's,
and
that's
it's over.
Kind of the, and now it's over. And then you kind of accept it when you're a kid because you look around at, you know, I'll speak for my case, right? Like, and you look around at your white classroom, you know, your classroom full of white students, and you think, well, these kids don't look like racist to me. Like I got nothing with, you know, like I got nothing against black people. I think this is probably solved. Like, this is fine, right? And then, of course, you grow up and you see the complexities of the world and you go, oh, wait, something totally different happened there. I always wondered about, like, this, you know, because of course Martin Luther King was assassinated, right? Like that's like the one thing that's like, it's hard to put in that story somewhere.
Right.
It's like, oh yeah, Martin Luther King happened and then we got the Civil Rights Act. With Minnesota right now, with Seattle right now, with like the places that all these protests are happening, one of the things that you consistently see people decry is when protesting turns to rioting.
Right.
Like it's, you consistently see that, like, well, people, you know, they can protest, but they really shouldn't be rioting. One thing I learned recently is that the Civil Rights Act was signed after Martin Luther King's assassination, and it was done in large part to quell the rioting that was happening in the streets because of it. So as a kid,
around the country,
As kids, we're taught about nonviolent resistance. And of course, it's the right way to go. We talk about Rosa Parks. We talk about counter sit-ins. And that stuff matters. That stuff's in the history books. But you know what got the Civil Rights Act signed? Was the rioting that was happening around the country. Like the fire that needed to be put out. And that is such a different view of history as what we were taught.
Right. And it's a reminder kind of the... So I think that's a really good point. And I think if listeners, if you're not familiar with the sort of riots that swept the country, protests and riots as well around that time, you should absolutely go down a Wikipedia rabbit hole. They were nationwide, and they're not really taught that much. But I think there's a tendency to present black people in American history as victims, as people to whom things happen, and without taking away the terror of slavery and the injustice of Jim Crow and systemic racism after that, I think one of the things that this book does well is give us a sense of a black woman, a former enslaved person, who is a free moral agent of her own, and she makes decisions. She is a person. She's not just like a sad former slave, and now let us think about how sad her life is. Like, she has to, she is a human being. She's fully realized. And you mentioned riots, and I think this is really important, because whenever I think about and talk about riots and civil unrest and protests, I just I realize that as a white person, I haven't had to deal with the sort of systemic oppression that people of color have had to deal with. And so I'm not really in a place to say, you shouldn't feel that angry. You shouldn't act on that anger. This is not my place, because I haven't had the stimuli to feel that anger. I haven't been oppressed. So I can't go around telling other folks not to be mad when I haven't had the reasons to be mad that oppressed, marginalized people will have been. And this book does a really good job clarifying how Setha is victimized, but she also is much more than a victim. She makes choices, she makes decisions, and she makes some morally questionable decisions. I teach this book, and one of my best in my critical theory class, and one of my best class days of conversation is when I ask, is Setha morally justified in killing her children?
Yeah.
And it's like this question which you don't have an answer for.
No.
She believes she is. My knee jerk is to say, well, like, no, murder is wrong. But the idea that slavery, and the slavery as she describes it, is a fate worse than death. Like, mm-hmm. the slavery that Setha was subjected to is horrifying. Like sexual assault, physical assault. Yeah.
Not to get into the nitty gritty of things, but sorry, what happened to the other kids? Did she have other kids? Yeah. Is that part of the story? Or, I mean, what the hell happened?
Setha escapes across the river, gives birth to the child as she's crossing the river, and she names her daughter Denver, her youngest daughter Denver. Denver survives, the two boys survive, and the two boys leave at the beginning of the book. But Denver is around for all this haunting, all this enfleshment of beloved. Denver is one of the ones who kind of gets people to come and help get beloved out of there. So Denver has to watch this. And one of the minor themes of the story is kind of like inherited trauma, how you get trauma from your forebears. And Denver has to watch her mother cope with the trauma of killing her own child. She has to watch the child try and fight back. And so, you know, like at the end of the story, Denver's going to be dealing with some stuff too.
Wow, this is as many layers as Joe's book for sure.
Well, this is one of the things I really like about, like, I mean, the racial storytelling slash history is super important, and the ideological element is important, and it's also like a great ghost story, but it's also really like the crisis.
How is it a great ghost story?
She gets re-enfleshed.
The ghost story, Thrand, is freaky as heck. It's just, she is so beloved, is so creepy. But the book like covers a ton of ground. It has a lot of story to tell, a lot of characters to introduce, a lot of relationships to explore, and it ramps up so naturally to this climax that when we get to that climax, it's absolutely, totally, completely earned.
Okay, so you mentioned that this is a book you teach. I think next week we should do a book you can't teach. Are there books that like you do not teach?
There are many books we don't teach.
Nick, this is actually both Joe and I are pretty enlightened, so we do cover every piece of literature ever written. We do everything.
Everything.
Before we wrap up, Nick, because that's where we're headed here, right? So I have one quick thing. I think like our best conversations when we get together like this have been when we can draw relationships between the two of them, right?
Heck yeah.
We can draw parallels between the two when these books are in conversation with each other in some way. And of course, we're talking about books here that are hundreds of years apart from totally different ideological point of views, et cetera. But I think one thing that I'm struck by when I read this is when I, coming from my place in this world, when I read Ben Franklin's autobiography, I do get inspired by it, right? Like it makes me feel hopeful. Like it makes me feel like I too can be a self-made man, right? Yeah. Like I too can like do great things in my life despite whatever upbringing I have, which
there's
was
a path.
Fantastic upbringing, right? There's a path available for me. One thing that's so obvious when you talk about Beloved though is like that blueprint that Franklin draws for what it means to be American, for the ideal American life, it is not available to everybody. Right. Like as a white dude growing up in Wisconsin from a middle-class background, I absolutely feel like that blueprint is available to me. Right. When you read Beloved, when you see Toni Morrison, whatever, it's very, very clear. Like that blueprint is not available to
Setha.
Setha.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That blueprint is not available to Setha. Right. Like it's a totally different world. And when you see the social unrest that's happening right now, when you see, you know, racial conflict happening right now and protests and streets, it's in the streets, etc. Like it's very clear, like a lot of that pent up anger, right? Like that anger that's being expressed right now is because that blueprint is not available to large swaths of the population today.
Yeah, it's like the blueprint is withheld. I really appreciate you kind of like bringing this into conversation here. The blueprint is withheld from a lot of folks, and yet those same folks are judged for not following the blueprint. So it's like they can't follow this path, the Ben Franklin 9 steps to financial success. But they're still asked, why aren't you? Why aren't you following this path? And I think it comes down to what is meant by America. I don't think that books like Beloved invalidate the sort of the idea of the blueprint, but they do show us, like you're saying, that the blueprint for being a successful American is contingent on people fitting a few demographic markers first. And you can't, like, it's off limits if you are fitting structurally, societally. It's off limits. It's been placed off limits for people who don't fit those. So being a good, successful American really means being a good, successful white, probably male, oftentimes middle class or higher. And yeah. I think Ben probably didn't realize this. I don't know. Maybe he did and he just didn't care. But like,
yeah,
when Ben is like putting this forward, he's not saying, I'm pitching this as for all Americans, but it's really just for a few narrow subset.
Oh my God, you sounded just like Benjamin Franklin.
I know. Just like it, that was uncanny.
Ben.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And I think like so often when we write from our own point of view, right, like what we leave out can be damning, right? Like it can absolutely be damning. And I think, you know, as you're talking about Beloved, I sit here and I'm trying to think back to the autobiography for Ben Franklin talking about race even once. And of course he doesn't, right? Because it's something that from his point of view, it's totally invisible to him, right? Like the world of owning slaves, the world of this subservience is, it's a natural fact in his world that he maybe hasn't thought much about. And I'm sure if you do some Googling, I'm sure Ben Franklin did write on slavery at some point, had some choice words for it.
Probably.
But it's absolutely not part of the autobiography.
Ben Franklin owned slaves.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Crap. Yeah.
Until late in his life.
Oh, wow. No.
What a dickhead.
Okay, this is why it's good to kind of balance
Google search things. Now, you were anti-Google. I am now strongly pro-Google.
Hard yes. This is why it's good to read books, to balance our sort of reading of books by white dudes with books by people who aren't white, people who aren't dudes. And not just that, but also like look at books that have non-white, non-male perspectives. Like Setha is black, and so she's already placed at a disadvantage in her society, but she's also a woman. Malcolm X said the most disrespectful, this is 1962, May 22nd, 1962. He said the most disrespected person in America is the black woman. So like this perspective, her perspective, she is so disempowered. She has no kind of authority or agency over her own life, and all she can do is like kill her baby with a saw. She takes a handsaw and slices its neck, and there's this horrible image of like she remembers the oily feel of the blood on her fingers. Like these perspectives, like it makes us look at the world in a whole different way, and I think that's good. That's why this is a good book.
And music,
not well, ending not Joe, with a bang but a whimper.
Joe, I think you won this. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, what?
your book sounds terrible. One point of correction here. Apparently, Franklin did start arguing against slavery and became an abolitionist. But
oh, cool.
I don't believe that.
That's nice.
But the majority of his life, he profited from slaves. Like, there's no way he would have gone on to do all these great things. In my cursory research on Wikipedia, that I don't know. It's hard to imagine that these people of great back then could accomplish these great things without slavery. Anyway,
it's possible. It's possible for people to change, for people to sort of, you know, come to the place of like realizing the value of, you know, not treating people like things. But like we also can't. So if that's possible, I hope that's the case. But we also can't just like give somebody a pass for.
Ian, do you have any quotes that would change the way we think?
Well, first, okay, yeah, two things. First of all, I have some further reading. Toni Morrison wrote an essay called "Mourning for Whiteness." It's in the New Yorker, and it talks about white privilege and sort of white supremacy. And it was written in 2016. It's quite recent. And she did pass away, but she speaks, I think, to our current moment. So I'd encourage you to check that out. I also encourage you to check out the song by the Decemberists, Ben Franklin's song. It is pretty funny. It's NSFW, not safe for work. And it was the episode. So Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote this song. He intended to use it in Hamilton. It was eventually cut, but the Decemberists perform it and
oh my God,
play the music. It's pretty good. You guys should listen to
this
it.
This is amazing.
Definitely though. Quite crude. Okay.
Wait, hold on. Before you go, want to hear a Hobbit fact?
Yeah.
All right. You may know this already, Ian.
Probably.
You are the Hobbit factian expert.
Yep.
Originally, Tolkien wanted to create the Elvish language. That was his original goal.
Yeah.
And to do that, he had to like create the entire like universe in the world of the Lord of the Rings. And that's why he wrote the books.
I told you he was like a perfectionist. He was like, well, I've got to do a language, but that means I have to do mythology, which means I have to do history.
It's such a hobbity thing.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of feel like, Nick, you're misunderstanding. Never mind. It's all good.
I don't think there's anything I'm misunderstanding.
Good.
I would like to point out, I'm reading the lyrics to this song right now, and the turkey is an extended metaphor throughout this song. It's very clever.
Look it up, guys. So next week we're doing books that we can't assign in school.
Unteachable
books.
Oh boy.
Not books that can't teach us something, but books that we could never teach our students.
Okay.
Yes, it's good.
I'm gonna do Frog and Toad Go Swimming.
Coloring books.
It's way too complex.
Don't think outside the box on this one.
Think inside the lines.
Yes. All right. Send us off, Ian.
All right. So this is a quote about the way that white supremacy and white supremacy kind of comes up with this mental image of violence and ascribes that violence to blackness, to black people. But this is a violence which belongs to and is imagined by and eventually kind of rebounds back upon whiteness and white supremacy. So this is, Morrison's really good at kind of capturing these big ideas and making them sound powerful and clear. And just for clarity, the sort of concept of violence, primitive racialized violence, is, she refers to it in this quote as the jungle. So, and this is a direct quote. "White people believed that whatever the manners, under every dark skin was a jungle. Swift, unnavigable waters, swinging, screaming baboons, sleeping snakes, red gum ready for their white, sweet blood. In a way, thought Paul D, they were right. The more colored people spent their strength trying to convince them, white people, how gentle they were, how clever and loving, how human, the more they used themselves up to persuade whites of something Negroes believed could not be questioned, the deeper and more tangled the jungle grew inside. But it wasn't the jungle blacks brought with them to this place from the other livable. It was the jungle white folks planted in them. And it grew. It spread. In, through, and after life, it spread until it invaded the whites who had made it, touched them, everyone, changed and altered them, made them bloody, silly, worse than even they wanted to be. So scared were they of the jungle they had made. The screaming baboon lived under their own white skin. The red gums were their own."